Over there.
Again, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed by us. It's been a pleasure meeting you, and we're looking forward to your sharing your story.
Okay, thank you.
So we're going to begin with some information about your background and childhood.
Oh, okay.
Tell me about your place of birth and about what was going on there when you were growing up.
See, I was born in Detroit, Michigan, but lived in a suburb outside of the city, and that suburb was primarily African American. The name of the town is Inkster, and the folklore goes it was called Inkster to represent the people who were living there. So I came directly from the hospital to the house that I grew up in, and really didn't leave there probably until maybe I was, 21 or something like that. Yeah. So what was going on? The war. I was 4 when the war began, Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things I remembered. We lived near Willow Run, which was a plant where planes were built, so we were subject to blackouts. And I remember victory gardens and ration books and people trading stamps, you know, if I needed a pair of shoes, but somebody else didn't need a pair of shoes, and my mom would trade their shoe stamps for our flower stamps or something like that. So I think I remember Armistice Day when it was declared. I also remember the next door neighbor disappearing because he was drafted, going away, and then of course he did come back later. Everybody knew everybody in the neighborhood, so that was really nice to grow up with that feeling that everybody knew everybody, except of course when you wanted to do something that you weren't supposed to do. Remember Bondly Halloween and Mrs. Simmons. Whenever we started out to go trick-or-treating, we always headed for Mrs. Simmons because she went elaborate on like cupcakes and all that. And there wasn't much violence. I didn't grow up with a lot of violence. I do remember there was one murder in the community. I remember the whole community went to where they had found the body, and it was in because in the Midwest you have basements, so you had to dig out the basement first, and then it had filled up with rain, and this is where they found the body. So that was the talk of the town for a long time. But like I said, everybody knew everybody. Occasionally my parents would, we always had a single family home, but occasionally they would board some of the local teachers, so that was always nice. We lived on a hill, we controlled the hill, because it wasn't paved at that time, so when it was snow, you know, if anybody wanted to sled down our hill, they had to pay, so that was lots of fun. So that's kind of a synopsis of childhood. Both parents were always in the home. That was very important. Our parents really wanted us. My dad had been married before, so I had two older stepsisters, stepbrother and stepsister, but they didn't live with us. So my parents were always in the home. My dad worked for the Ford Motor Company. He came when they were recruiting. After the war, after First World War, he moved to Detroit in 1922, I think it was 22, to work for the Ford Motor Company. And my mom was a traditional housewife. Everything was pretty traditional. I know she attempted to work for maybe a couple of months, and my dad said, "I really don't want you working," because the job that she had was as a domestic, and he really didn't want that. So she stayed at home. But what she did was, she decided to be, both of them decided to be foster parents for the Children's Aid Society of Detroit. So that's how she kept herself busy, because she really liked babies. She didn't like us too much when we got But she liked babies, so she always took babies. So I grew up with foster children. I'm a retired psychotherapist, so one of the things I want to comment about was, and people have encouraged me to write about grief and loss in children, because I remember on one occasion, before I was going off to school, I went in to say goodbye to one of the children that was returning to their home. And of course, I've never seen that child. Again, I don't have any idea what happened to them. So I have a lot of abandonment issues. You know, even if I give clothes away, I have to sort of deconstruct from them for a while because they're, you know, it's about being separated. You know, issues of separation. So, and I grew up with an older brother. He's 4 years older than I am. So I guess that's kind of a synopsis of childhood. Maybe the other thing I would say is, like I said, my parents really wanted us. So they made a real point to give us lots of stimulation. What I mean by that is, you know, we could take the bus into Detroit to go to the museum. We could have people stay over. We went to camp. My mother was a leader for Girl Scouts. My father was the treasurer for the local PTA for years and years and years. So education was really, I mean, that was really important. And so they made an effort. The school, the high school, well, let me back up for a minute, because grade school, they realized I was getting bored about the fifth grade, so they skipped me a grade. Intellectually, it was fine. Socially, it put me, I was a little out of it socially. I never caught up till later. And then in high school, the high school was not an accredited high school. So my dad was affirmative action. We were bused in. We took, meaning the local bus, into Detroit to go to one of the high schools because we were college bound. At least I was. My brother had another idea, but I was college bound. So I went into Detroit to go to school. You know, we took the local bus. Dad would, you know, depending on the shift that he was working, he would, you know, sometimes drive us in. So I think maybe that's kind of the highlights, unless there's some more specific questions.
Yeah. Who were your best friends, and where were their parents from?
Best friend, Barbara Baylor. Her father was principal of the school that I went to, but Barbara couldn't go to that school because her father was principal. I think the Baylors were from kind of a periphery, maybe it was Alabama. It might have been from Alabama. So there was Barbara Baylor, and there was Virginia Holt. Let's see, who else? All these kids come to mind. Wildred Morrison. Barbara Coleman. Her parents were from Louisiana. Wildred Morrison, I don't know where they were from. Can't remember. Virginia Holt, I don't remember where she was from. Her parents were from. But that was about it. Oh, and then of course as I got older, you know, then boys. The Borders boys, James and Floyd, his parents, they moved out to Inkster from Detroit, but I don't know exactly where they were from. But a lot of people had migrated up from the South to Detroit, primarily because of the Ford Motor Company.
What was your greatest passion or interest, or what did you most like to get into?
At growing up?
Yes.
Behind the house was a big field and baseball. So I was referred to as slugger. I always got chosen to play. So that was a passion. And then the climate in Michigan is really funny because there's a Gulf Stream that comes up to the Great Lakes. So in Michigan, what you can have during the winter, what can happen, it can warm up enough to rain and then plummet, so that all of that freezes over. So we had a big cement driveway in the backyard, so Dad would flood it even more, and then we would have skating, ice skating. So that was always fun. Other passions? I think I've probably always been reflective. So sometimes, especially during the summer, I would get up really early, about 5:30 or 6 o'clock when the rest of the family was sleeping, and I would go climb into, we had peach trees, rather large peach trees. I would climb into the peach tree and reflect, and I would sometimes think about, I think I was maybe 6 or 7 at the time, and I would think, I wonder what I'm going to be like when I'm 19. Those are the kind of questions I would think about, and then everybody would get up and, you know, get my reverie time. Any other passions? Well, jumping rope, riding bicycles. I guess that was about it. As a child, mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was school like? What do you remember most about your time as a school child?
Liking school. I remember my first day of school. I was 5, because my birthday fell in April, so I went in September. I even remember what I wore. I had a little plaid skirt, white blouse, and a little jacket. And Miss Allen, I think, was the kindergarten teacher. Wasn't intimidated, quiet, wasn't intimidated. So for me, school was good, except as I began to move toward, you know, 4th and 5th grade, then I began to get bored. I didn't get into trouble or anything like that, but I began to get bored because, you know, the way kids were taught, I remember, you know, kind of a spring afternoon and having to sit in class and listen to Leonard Defoe, who was not a good reader, read his paragraph, you know, in geography. You know, poor Leonard would stumble, and, you know, it took him, you know, anyway, so I got really, really bored with that. But one of the other things that I remember, and I've often thought about, was there was another kid, and his name was Leonard, oh, maybe it's not important, Leonard Davis. Leonard was talented when it came to the piano, very talented, but academically he was not good. And so what the teachers would do would be, you know, take the ruler and hit him in his palm, which of course did not encourage him to learn. It just terrified him. So, you know, it would really upset me to see him become anxious as he tried to participate in class. I could see her face, but I can't remember her name. She came in and she taught music, and that was fun. I enjoyed that idea.
What was the cultural and racial background of your classmates and teachers?
Primarily all African, of African descent.
Okay. What were your favorite subjects and classes, and what made them your favorite?
I liked geography, you know, wondering what the Nile looked like. So geography, never cared for math. I liked reading. English was okay. All those humanitarian kinds of things were easy for me. But, you know, I think math would have been much easier, too, if there wasn't that kind of, I don't know how I got the message, but, you know, girls and math. Yeah, so to this day, you know, my original computer was where my, even, you know, was counting on my fingers, which was discouraged. So I think those were favorite subjects. And after we got into junior high, I liked science. I did. I think those were some of my favorite ones, yeah.
What were your favorite books? What did you like most about them?
Favorite books, probably Little Women and The Three Musketeers. Little Hannibal. It was probably one of the first books where the subjects of kids were African American. I remember. Oh yeah. It's not. The Christmas Carol. Yeah, I think it was The Christmas Carol. I think I was 1934 when I first heard that story. Anyway, it's a 1930s protest story. And so what it's about is it's called A Little Match Girl. And so here she is on Christmas Eve, and her family is really poverty-stricken. She's selling matches. I remember the illustration in the book. She was outside on the stairs, and she was looking through the window, and you know, they were all decorated, and they were dancing. But she was trying to sell her matches on Christmas Eve, and of course nobody paid any attention to her, and she froze to death on the steps of this house. Upset me tremendously, but every year I would demand reading that story until, of course, I could read it again. Those were some of the books that I particularly remember. Anything else in terms of books? As a matter of fact, I still have those books. We got a set of the classics, so I still have Little Women, of all those books that we had.
Okay. Did you have social studies classes or an equivalent?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you remember about them in terms of content and your feeling about them?
I remember Barbara Baylor's uncle had been stationed in Hawaii, and he brought back Hawaiian music. And when we were in Ms. Miller's class, Frances Miller, she realized, you know, of course, puberty was setting in. And so what she would do was Barbara would bring her Hawaiian records to class, and she'd have us dance in class. And then, you know, maybe say something about the Hawaiian culture. So that's, I think, primarily what I remember about social studies.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a newspaper. I worked on the newspaper. I think I maybe even wrote a couple of articles. I don't remember what I wrote about. But I remember working on it. You had the old-fashioned mimeograph. Mimeograph and machines. And you had to, you know, ink them down and put the stylus on and all that kind of stuff. So that's social studies. I guess that was about pretty much what I remember about social studies.
Okay. Tell me about your parents and grandparents. What were they like, and what was your favorite thing about them?
Parents. Let's start with parents. My dad's name is Junius. Kind of an unusual name, Junius Randolph. And my mother was Cora May. Dad had been married before. His family came in from Florida. My mom's family was Cherokee, and so all of her family was in Oklahoma. I'll say a little bit more about my mom's family, because I think I know the history better. Mom was born in Oklahoma in 1906, when Oklahoma was still a territory.
Mm-hmm.
So every child that was born that was at least a quarter Native American inherited land. So she was more than a quarter, since she was half. So she inherited land. And that homestead was around Tulsa, Bartlesville, Nowar, Oklahoma. Then they discovered oil, and I guess the company who was responsible for that was Phillips 66. Mm-hmm. It was probably merged. Are you okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're
my allergies.
Phillips 66 used to be. Actually, they probably maybe have gone out of business anyway. Anyway, oil was in Oklahoma. So the United States government rented the oil, and while my mother was growing up, the first of every month, it was called Hayden Payment Days, and all of the people who renting their land to the United States government would come into Nowater, this is the town that she was born in and lived in, to collect their money. So, and of course, a lot of the people, of course, were Native American, and the tribes around Oklahoma, you know, Cherokee, Choctaw, those were the major tribes. So she had wonderful stories to tell us about
you know, the Indians coming in with on their horses and or driving their big expensive cars, coming in to collect their royalties. So her family was fairly well off. Her older brothers and sisters went to boarding school. It was one of those Indian families, one of those Indian boarding schools. You know, because there was this whole thing where they took Indian kids from their families and sent them off to schools. She did not go because eventually the United States government, of course, forgot to pay the royalties. So her family, and also her father, Grandpa on her side, who was alcoholic, so the family then fell into poverty. But I will say, just to fill in this information, I think it was in 1950 the Cherokee Nation sued the United States government for all of those back royalties. And by that time, my mother, I think, was one of nine, not including the parents, one of nine. So she filled out all those papers. I remember sitting with her at the dining room table where she filled out all those papers. And so she collected for her entire family. I asked her, I said, Ma, how much money did you get? It is none of your business, but if you need to go to school, if you need to do a PhD, you know, you don't have to worry about that. But I never knew how much she collected. So that's a little bit about mother. Grandma, I remember my grandmother because when I was six, she came to visit. Grandma was very silent.
Mother's mother?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess you would say, if you wanted to be sort of stereotypical, you would say she's sort of a silent wooden Indian.
Mm-hmm.
Was very silent. But one of the things she said was she didn't like little girls. She liked my older brother, but she made it clear that she didn't like little girls. So when I was six, I didn't know the word F-U-C-K.
Mm-hmm.
But my attitude was, huh, okay, you don't like me, I don't like you.
Mm-hmm.
So I avoided her, really. I have a letter from her where she's saying how much she loves me, but she never said that, and my mother never said that to me. In all of the growing up years, she never once said, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I guess she inherited that from her own mother. So that was Grandma. Grandpa, John Brown, his family was from around Kansas. And I think he also was probably mixed race. I must say, on my mother's side, are you familiar with the old-time philosopher Will Rogers? You probably are not familiar with him. He was sort of like an old-timey philosopher.
I'm familiar with the name, but I couldn't associate it with anything specific.
Yeah.
Describe it.
He would be like, who does the Prairie Companion?
Yes.
Anyway, he was related to the family and how that, and that came next. So he was all part of the family. I guess he was sleeping with the same Indians that were sleeping, you know, with everybody else. So that's how he got related. So Grandpa Brown, John Brown, was from around Kansas. I remember his sister Aunt Carrie. I remember because she had still was wearing high button shoes and a long dress. Catherine, everybody called her Carrie, but her name was Catherine, extremely dignified. And my grandpa was a cowboy. That's what he did. And I remember reading maybe several years ago, somebody has done a study on black cowboys.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it was from that part of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So he rode and was a cowboy, and one of the ways he kept it in the winter time, one of the ways he kept his feet warm, of course they wore boots, he would pour whiskey inside of his boots, and that kept his feet from freezing. It was alcohol.
Well, yeah.
So that's how they kept their feet warm. I remember when I was four, we went to Oklahoma to visit, and so I remember his face, big, silent, not very talkative. I think at that time my brother has later pointed out that my parents might have been in the process of separating. I remember my mother trying to talk to her parents. I remember her crying, and she got no kind of response.
No support?
No support from them, and that really stuck it out in my mind. My brother wasn't there because he was old enough. She had enrolled him in school, so I was there. Well, and then things, I guess, got smoothed over because I remember coming back to Detroit on the train, and that's when servicemen were also, I guess, coming back in. I remember I had a seat from Nowhere to Kansas City or something like that, and now there's a whole pile of servicemen that got on, and so I lost my seat, and so I ended up sitting in the service guy's lap, well, entertaining me. So it was okay. So that's a little bit about grandma and grandpa, maternal mother. One of the things that I really liked about it was special for my mother, like I said, she really focused on us, on our kids. And one of the things I always liked about her is if she made an error, like for example, if you ask her, could I go do something? And, you know, she might say no, but if you could come back later and say, well, Mrs. Baylor, Mrs. Holt, they're all going to be there, they're all going to chaperone, I don't understand why I can't go, then she would change her mind and she would apologize. And my dad was the exact opposite. You know, kids were supposed to be heard and not seen. He would not apologize. And one of the things he would do is to irritate me to no end.
I can see it.
No irritation to no end. We would be sitting at the dinner table because dinner was important. That was we all, whenever we could, we always ate dinner together. And he would say, "Get me the water out of the refrigerator." What I didn't like was the demand. Now, would you please? So etiquette was big in our house. So I would say, oh, Daddy, you didn't say please. You have to say please. And you could see the vein tightening in his neck. And so he wouldn't say please. I wouldn't get the water. And my mother would support us by saying, Junior, you need to say please. You know, we're talking about etiquette. He wouldn't do it, so I didn't have to get the water. I'm kind of trying to maybe tie in a number of things. That's one of the things I disliked about my dad, was his children are seen, not heard. Whereas with my mother, that was not the case. If you could talk to her and explain, profanity or anything like that was never, and the N-word was never allowed mm-hmm. in our house. So you could talk to her and you could explain, and she was open to hearing that. So I really like that. My dad, you were safe with him. I mean, he protected his family. I grew up with a big 45 in the house. We had a two-story house, and so there was always a chute that would go in one of the bedrooms. But if you took the linen off the bed, you would just put it down the chute. It would go down to the basement and land in, a cage. And there was an opening on that side of the chute, and that's where guns was kept. So, and then when we got older as teenagers, there was a gang that started in Detroit. They were called the Shakers and the Shakerettes. Bad gang. I think they were smoking marijuana. They called them reefers. They were smoking marijuana. And if people tried to have a party, the Shakers or the Shakerettes would crash your party. Da, 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 da. But there was no problem. We had parties, and Dad would patrol. He would patrol that up. You know, nobody's coming out here and crashing the party. So that we always knew that. So back to trying to get back to your question. What did I like most? Now to go over to his side of the family. Dad was born in De Leon Springs, Florida, in 1895. Yeah, 1895. So you see, I go back really kind of far because I'll say this past April I turned 70. So,
my Lord.
I have this back history. That's why I can talk about the war and remember those kinds of things because I'm obsessed with that. Where I'm coming from.
You look very young.
Thank you.
I'm sincerely blown away that she's 70.
I'm 70. Yeah, just turned 70, so I have this history. Anyway, Dad was born 1895 in De Leon Springs, Florida. I think there were six older. He might have been number seven. And then after him was Uncle Chris. And when his mother was having Chris, she died in childbirth. And my middle name, Daphne, mm-hmm. comes from my paternal grandmother. Mm-hmm. So there were all the Walker boys, very hardworking, very industrious. My paternal grandmother was Daphne Reed, and I think she came from, I think, North Carolina, maybe South Carolina. I'm not really clear about that. And my grandfather, his name was Adam Walker. I should say my maternal grandpa was John Brown, and my maternal grandmother was Amanda. Sorry, I don't think I gave you the names. So paternal grandparents were Daphne and Adam. We're not exactly sure where Adam Walker came from. He may have been born in Florida. We're not exactly sure. But he dove for sponges. You know, now sponges are all kinds of, I think they're all artificial. Mm-hmm. But, you know, sponges grow natural in water. So apparently he was an excellent diver. So that's one of the things he did. Was dive for sponges. So everybody stayed pretty much in the same neighborhood. There's a family story on my dad's side. In De Leon, everybody knew everybody. The sheriff was Caucasian, but he knew everybody. He knew the Walker boys. So apparently there was a new sheriff, you know, mm-hmm. that came in. I think he came in from Mississippi or someplace. Mm. And he insulted Uncle Chris. So everybody was sort of in, you know, the little corner story when Chris came in. He told a story about what had happened. He said, "I just stopped by to say goodbye because I'm going home to get the gun. And today is the day of reckoning. That's not going to happen. I'm going to kill him." So somebody heard Chris say this, and they ran home. By this time, of course, their mother's dead. So the only sister in the family was Aunt Janie. So she raised all the kids. So somebody ran home before Chris could get there to tell Aunt Janie what he was going to do. So she hid the gun so that he couldn't find it. So it kept him from doing that. But as a result, the sheriff was moved. He didn't stay there. That sheriff disappeared and went someplace else. So I think I'm telling that story in a way to say the kind of honor. I mean, one way you could get yourself killed mm-hmm. with my father was if you insulted him, his honor, or if you threatened his family in any way. So that's, let's see, is there anything else about? Well, when I think forgotten how old he was when World War I, Dad started, and so he was in World War I, went to France. They were just about to move up to the front when the armistice was signed, so he did not actually see any battle, but he was in France. I have his story on tape as part of my. In my archives, so to speak.
What do you know about their passions or interests?
Dad was civic. Mm-hmm. He was very civic minded. He read the newspaper daily from stem to stern, and he was religious. Mm-hmm. They weren't joiners. But people we entertained a lot. Family friends would come out for dinner. Mm-hmm. You know, we'd have dinner afterwards, and Dad would sort of push back on the table and say, "Well, Gifford, that was his best friend. Well, Sullivan, what did you think of what they said in the paper about such and such?" Mm-hmm. So I would sit and listen. Mm-hmm. I always loved to sit and listen to them. talk. My mother's passion, I think, was her family, mm-hmm. taking care of us. So, like, there was a nutritionist called Victor H. Lenoir that came on at noon every day. Faithfully, she listened to him. And so that's the kind of food we got. You know, growing up in an African-American neighborhood, you know, all the other kids, sometimes other families were eating a lot of pork mm-hmm. or a lot of vegetables that were just cooked and cooked and cooked and cooked. Not as we were eating rutabagas and brains. So, you know, whatever menus he sometimes came up with, that's what we ate. So my mother took care of her herself. She had good prenatal care. She had access to good prenatal care and nutritionally. Because she was very interested in home economics. Mm-hmm. She tried to go to the university. I think it was in Colorado or someplace, but she didn't have the support of her parents, and so she couldn't do that. But she was very much interested in economics and nutrition. So her passion was, again, taking care of us, keeping the house in good order, making sure everything was neat, good furniture, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
So you've answered part of the next question. It's what are their professions, and were any of them military men or women? We've talked a bit about professions.
Yeah, no, mm-hmm. nobody was in, well, Dad was in the military, mm-hmm. And he got out in Cleveland. He was discharged in Cleveland and then headed for Detroit. But nobody else was in the military. He worked for the Ford Motor Company. At first, in the foundry, that's where a lot of the blacks came in. They worked in the foundry. And then he did some training, and he was responsible for keeping the temperatures on the big furnaces, keeping them, monitoring those. And Mom was a housewife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. What do you remember knowing about their jobs? Did you ever see them at work or go to work with them?
We would sometimes, if Mom wanted the car to take us somewhere, mm-hmm. she would drop Dad off. So I do know where he worked. And there is a very important memory for me about my dad's work. I talked to him a little bit about how he had to monitor the furnaces. And he worked with, Thomas. Can't remember Mr. Thomas's first name. But they all worked together. And there was a breakdown. One of the big steel furnaces had a problem. So they were repairing it. And they had to go inside of this big furnace to see what was wrong. And there was a small tunnel. Dad crawled out, but before Mr. Thomas could get out, they heated up, they started the furnace again. So he was very badly burned, and of course he didn't survive. Mm-hmm. That. If it had been the other way around, then it would have been my dad. But mm-hmm. Dad crawled out first, so I remember that morning, everybody was so upset. He hadn't died by then. Mr. Thomas wasn't dead by then. He was in the hospital, but everybody was so upset. I must say, Dad's other passion was union. Mm-hmm. He was a staunch mm-hmm. union person. Mom was always at home. Like I said, she participated in Girl Scouts. She did a lot of sewing, so she made clothes for herself and me. Like I said, she was very interested in nutrition. I think if she had had the opportunity to go, I'm sure she would have been a home economics mm-hmm. major or nutritionist.
Okay. Did they have any particular mantras that they constantly repeated to you as a guide for your behavior or approach to life? And you can consider parents and grandparents.
You work before you play. Mm-hmm. That was one. Just because anybody else is doing it doesn't mean you have to do it. Mm-hmm. This was Dad's mantra. Another one. This came from Dad. Mom certainly supported it. This was in relationship to, how can I succinctly express this? I just said Dad's honor was very important to him. So he would always say, carry yourself in a dignified manner, and then if they, meaning Caucasians, were insulting to you, you had presented yourself in such a way that their treatment would be unacceptable to you. So that was a mantra. Mm-hmm. And one of the words that that was included in that mantra was qualification. Always be qualified. Another mantra. There are three doors on this house. If you don't like what you have, let's see if I get it right. If you don't like living here, there are three doors on this house, and you're welcome to leave at any time. Of course, where the fuck home go? I never ran away.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So that was a mantra. I think those are the ones that come to mind. Yeah.
Would you mind sharing a particular instance when you did something that made them feel that you especially needed to have adhered to that mantra, to those mantras?
No, I was a pretty good. I did not give them any trouble. They got off easy with me. I didn't give them any trouble.
Okay.
Nothing immediately comes to mind. One of the things they didn't talk about was there was no sex information.
Mm-hmm.
That was totally neglected. So they pretty much monitored my activity. But I do remember I was in college and I was having some difficulty, and I decided what my major was going to be because I got railroaded. Mom, trying to carry out my mother's wishes. I was a home economics major, and I realized I was dying in that major.
Mm-hmm.
So my grades weren't very good. So they were going to let me take a Lincolnshire State University, which is in East Lansing. So they were going to let me take a term off, or sometimes a quarter off. I was going to go to Florida to hang out with cousins and get to know them. And then at the last minute, they changed their mind because they didn't want anybody to think I had gotten pregnant and had to go away.
So just the perception that...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I think both of them were very conscious of what other people might think. As a matter of fact, I knew that. I was trying to think of something else, but they were very conscious of that. Because I can remember saying, I don't live my life for other people. But I was in college by that time.
This is something we've kind of addressed to some degree. Where were they from? Mm-hmm. Did they ever have to or choose to migrate from one place to another? If so, do you know what prompted them to do so?
Well, part of my dad's migration was being drafted. I think he was drafted. I don't think he volunteered for World War I. And then when he was discharged, he responded to the call from Ford Motor Company. Detroit was booming then in terms of building cars.
So that move was from where to where?
He I don't know where he was inducted into service. I think it was in Florida. But he was discharged in Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay.
And then he did not stay in Cleveland. Mm-hmm. He immediately went to Detroit. Mm-hmm. And that's where my parents met. My mother migrated because no water was just too confining. She did not want to marry anybody native. And again, it was stereotypical stuff. They were not industries. So she went to Colorado. She worked in service for a family, and the family moved to Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how she got to Detroit, and that's where she met my father.
Okay. Is there anything about your grandparents' movement you'd like to?
Like I said, I don't know where Adams
mm-hmm.
from, but there was some migration there. And on the maternal side, I don't think there's a lot.
Okay. Did they find the culture of the place to which they moved to be different from the place from which they moved? What did or do they tell you about the experience? What did they tell you about the experience?
Well, our community, because it was a suburb, it was much more cosmopolitan. We had access to many more cosmopolitan things. Whereas I think in their communities, my father's community, was church, I think. My mother's community. I don't really know. I don't think I really know that much.
Okay. Did they maintain the culture of their original home?
My mother did.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
In what way? What leads you to to understand
neat.
What you did.
Of course, I guess everybody, maybe it was just an Appalachian thing. Mm-hmm. Or we ate lots of beans, mm-hmm. Fried bread.
Mm-hmm.
She maintained the lore, you know, wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
She maintained some medicinal stuff. Like if we got, gosh, I hate flannel very day. but we had flannel, what do you call them, Dr. John's, you know, those things that drop pajamas within the sock. We got him still around. And if we got a cold, we lots of times for Thanksgiving, we had geese. We didn't have a lot of turkey, we had goose.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would render the grease off the goose, mix it with Vicks
rub,
and put it on our chest. So she may, and my mother was not particularly religious. She was more spiritual,
mm-hmm.
very spiritual. Like, you know, she would tell us about, watch the birds. She'd tell us about the birds. She could smell, she says, you know, she would say it's going to rain because she would smell
mm-hmm.
The rain. In the spring, she would go out and go hunt wild dandelion greens.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, she maintained. And my mom was aloof. She wasn't, dad was gregarious. He would talk to the devil and mm-hmm. explain to the devil his position about life.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother was very aloof. Yeah. So I think I inherited a lot. I've changed a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was a lot like her. I look like her.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was a lot like her in terms of being shy and being much more withdrawn.
Mm-hmm. Were aspects of that culture passed on to you in some way?
Spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was. I'm not a Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm much more spiritual. I think she reflected a lot. I think I'm extremely reflective, maybe too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then of course I got tied in with my profession, which is psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when I retired, I worked for the University of California, and I had private practice. And when I retired from the University of California, the Berkeley campus in 2004. And in 2003, in October, I went to a workshop in New Mexico. And it was one of the workshops that I took was spirituality and therapy. And I think his name is Bill O'Hannigan or Bill Hannigan. And this is his conceptualization, but he really conceptualized for me what my work
mm-hmm.
was about, is about. Because my work was very important to me. I knew that I was not interested in corporate America. I've mm-hmm. always been interested in service. And that started really early. Like I said, my parents were foster parents. So the social worker would come to visit
mm-hmm.
the kids, and I would sit at the top of the stairs and listen to her mm-hmm. conversation as she talked with my mother about how they were doing, about parenting kinds of skills.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's another very important piece
mm-hmm.
was that so those visits from the social worker because my mom listened to that and certainly applied it to us. So that was very meaningful for me. And of course, I pursued that route. She wanted me to do nutrition. Somebody else wanted me to do doctor. But no, it was therapy. It was psychotherapy.
Okay.
So anyway, at this particular workshop, I mean, I think he really conceptualized what my spirituality is about. And he talks about it in terms of the three C's. And that is connection, compassion,
mm-hmm.
and contribution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I try in to facilitate or to actualize my spirituality. Connection is to really know people.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for counseling and psychological services, and like we were a family there. We, you know, we really connected.
Mm-hmm.
We said, I mean, I knew, you know, what's going on with their kids. You know, when my parents died, they were there for me. I mean, that kind of mm-hmm. connection. I never dreaded going to work because that connection was there. Some of my good friends. I mean, that's how I made the connection, was there. In terms of compassion, I remember working with a Vietnam nurse. And I had forgotten about this. I think I had forgotten about it because I was traumatized, secondary trauma. Because what she talked with me about was going out and collecting, bringing in the body parts, mm-hmm. trying to put them together so they can make some kind of identity. And, you know, the only thing I could do as I was listening to that was as she was huddled in her chair. What could I say? There was nothing I could say. I could just go put my arm around her mm-hmm. and just let her go.
That's okay.
Just to let her know I was there. Mm-hmm. Oh, and then I remember another young woman that I worked with.
Some water?
Yes, she was great.
I'll
give her water. There was another young woman that I worked with, and she had been abused, seriously abused. Her mother knew about it. It was another family relative. He would do things like put cigarettes mm-hmm. out on her arms. And she got a diagnosis that there was, there was a lump that needed to be that she needed to have treated. So I remember during one of our sessions, we worked for a number of years, and I know she finally reached the place where she could trust. And so she said, "Would you go with me to my appointment?" I didn't analyze this. I just said, "What time do you want me to be there, and where mm-hmm. is it?" And I was there. So I feel like that connection, compassion, contribution. Working with a perpetrator who was an abuser, and I thought, "Oh, can I do this? And then listening to how he was abused, and the sadness and the loneliness that he had about that, and connecting mm-hmm. with him on that. So, my work. I guess that's spiritual.
Were there other family elders that played a significant role in your life? What were they like?
Family elders. No, I think because of the migration pattern, we were really isolated from family. But my parents made up with that by having good family friends. Mm-hmm. So I remember Louise and Gifford Sullivan. They were good family friends, and if something had happened to my parents, I'm sure they would have stepped in mm-hmm. and taken care of us. And then Aunt Janie, the my father's sister, who reared them after their mother died, she would come periodically to visit. And although we weren't really, really real, real close, I mean, I liked having her come visit. So, not a lot of family elders.
Okay. As far as you know, did your parents, grandparents, or family elders, I guess extended family in this case, ever have or express the desire to go abroad?
Because I remember asking my dad, because he was in France. I said, "Daddy, wouldn't you ever?" No interest whatsoever. My mother, said, always talked about broadening your horizons, but I don't think she ever thought about mm-hmm. going out of the country. Yeah. No, I don't think there was a lot of interest in international.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Did they ever have the opportunity to go abroad? I know you said your father had been in France.
I don't think so. Okay. I mean, they could have pursued it, but
they didn't. Mm-hmm. Okay. What were their perceptions, you think, of abroad? What did that mean to them?
I think it was void. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. Because they didn't talk about it. Mm-hmm. Well, let me maybe rescind that a little bit. One of the things that happened My father worked with, oh, I almost had his name. You see his face. He's Japanese. And he'd been interned. And he would come to the house sometimes. And he and Daddy would sit at their table and talk about his experience. And I remember he always wanted to go back to Japan, go back to Japan, go back to Japan. My mother loved him because he had such elegant manners, you know, the traditional, you know, Japanese manners. And so he did get a chance to go back to Japan. And when he came back, he brought a gift for each one of us. I still have that scarf.
Mm-hmm.
That's still my favorite scarf that he brought back. So maybe part of the perception, I think probably my mother's perception was, maybe she would have gone to Japan, I don't know, because she really admired him a lot. So that memory comes back. And my dad, I think because he was in a different country at a very inopportune time, I think it felt safe for him. I think probably felt safe for him to stay put.
Where have you traveled? Feel free to list as many locations as you wish.
You don't have my sheet of paper.
I can have your sheet of paper.
I will add some more.
Yes, I have your sheet of paper.
I'll let you write them as I think about it. Because I think what I didn't put on there was Canada, Mexico, Venezuela. Canada, Mexico, Venezuela. Because we had property in Canada. I regret that I did not hang on to that property. But Lake Erie would go into Rondeau Bay, which is all connected into Canada, so we would go up there a lot. And then St. Croix, the American Virgins. And I think that covers it.
So that adds to your list of Brazil, Aruba, Haiti, Spain, England, Denmark, Norway, Bermuda, Curaçao, Bahamas, Trinidad and Tobago, Puerto Rico, Grenada, Cuba, Martinique, Guadeloupe, and Barbados.
And then the ones I just...
And then the same. Okay. What are your favorites out of these locations? We're going to focus on experiences, and we know about Cuba. We're going to focus on experiences and up to five of those. So the top 3 to 5 mentions, so we know Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk about Cuba. What are the earliest, what did you think about Cuba before you went there?
Well, like I said, my cousin's a music. Yeah, like I said, I just really tuned into that. 16, just, oh, I need to go, I'm going to go to Cuba, because Cousin Ray, that's my husband's also, my husband's name is Ray, spelled differently, and I didn't get to do it, and then I got enmeshed in doing other kinds of stuff, and then one of my clients that I was working with, she was an anthropologist, and she was doing, I think, work, her work was from Puerto Rico. But I think she talked about some of the Caribbean Afro-based religions. And so by this time, of course, Cuba was just beginning to maybe open up. And so I said, you know, I've got to do this. And so every when I was walking home from work, I would walk past a store called Global Exchange. Global Exchange is a reality-based tour, I'll just say agency, in San Francisco. So their idea is bringing people together. So to this very day, they still offer focus tours. And so I discovered that they were offering a focus tour to Cuba, focused on Afro-Cuban culture. So when so I came out of the store and I thought, oh my goodness, and I said, you know, can I go? She said, yeah, I have to do it. So I ran, oh God, a serious checkbook. Called Global Exchange and signed up. So that was in July of 1995. I was so excited. Because one of the things I'll back up and say, you know, Dad didn't want me to go to Cuba because I was 16. And, you know, he knew I wouldn't come back in the same condition I mean, if you follow my drift, but he also knew it was the beginning of a revolution.
Yes.
And so that was, he didn't want me involved in that. So, so I was just so excited. I've written about some of this stuff just to myself, but the route that I took was the Bahamas, and then from the Bahamas into Havana. Destiny and Tracy, I cannot begin to tell you how I felt at that plane began to descend into the Jose Marti Airport. I was just like something finally was, you know, was happening. And I had done a lot of traveling to these other places. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that upset me about traveling to these other places was seeing the same old, same old. On one side, all the rich, usually Caucasian people, mm-hmm. private beaches, sealed off everything. On the other side of the island were the indigenous native people living in poverty. Mm-hmm. I would do these trips and I would come back home and would be depressed for the rest of the summer. So when I got to Cuba, everybody's poor in Cuba. It was at least more even.
Yeah.
It was more even.
Okay.
And there was all these rich people everywhere. But, but the glaring disparity wasn't there. So that was the first trip. I felt like I just see the diaspora there to reconnect with that. One of the things I would like to say, my mother, like I said, she was aloof. She was part Native. You know, she wasn't all Native, but she did not honor the African side of herself. So she thought everything was white was good. Mm-hmm. So this, again, for Cuba, was a reconnection with that side that was not honored. Mm-hmm. So that was another very, very, very important aspect of Cuba, and the religion was an aspect. You know, my father, who was so fundamental, and you know, I could not talk with him. Couldn't talk with him about, you know, Africa. They had culture. You know, it wasn't like, you know, running around. They had culture, and it was taken. That was Cuba. That was 1995, when you go sometimes under the auspices of organization and agency, you get to see a lot of things. So they were still in their special period. So when I first went to Cuba and I was in Santiago de Cuba, the stores were empty. There was not a thing. My husband tells me that before the Soviet Union dissolved, and Cuba had their alliance with theirs, and he said, they had everything. You could buy things on credit, you know. But the time that Soviet Union fell apart, there was nothing there. And he said, you know, you would see people that you'd seen, and you'd see them 3 months later, and you hardly recognized them because they lost so much, so much weight. But we went to places like a school for the hearing challenged. And there was, and even the club, they brought in entertainment for the kids, and so he did everything, all of that entertainment, you know, with language, sign language. I remember going to Santiago because it was they hadn't had the money, they hadn't had carnival for several years, but that year they were having carnival. It was pretty meager. They had food for the tourists, but for the Cubans, there was nothing. But, you know, a Cuban, somebody would buy a big bucket of beer, and it was passed around. Mm-hmm. So we made a decision, we're not going to eat any of the food. We're going to watch carnival. Mm-hmm. But if we have anything, we're going to pass it around. And there was a little boy, there was two boys that were sitting next to our party. He must have been 10, and his little brother must have been 3 or something, or 4 or something like that. And we were passing around. We had potato chips that we were going to pass around. You could see the 3-year-old wanted some of the potato chips, but his brother just went. you don't beg mm-hmm. for anything. But of course we share. Mm-hmm. You know, we passed it all around. And when we left, one of the Stephen Washington took off his baseball cap and gave it to the, mm-hmm. the 10-year-old who was just odd. So we saw lots of things in Cuba, and I came home feeling, and still was hope. It's not perfect, but at least somebody had attempted to try something different. Mm-hmm. And so I was just really impressed with that, and I'm still impressed with that. You know, people have all kinds of feelings about Fidel. But one of the things I will give him absolute credit for is how he has how Cubans are well educated mm-hmm. and how they are physically taken care of, and the dignity that they have mm-hmm. With that. Some of the housing is horrible, but the way in which they carry themselves, and the you know, it's not a lot of violence. Okay. There are a lot of things. There's the sharing. I didn't go back in 96. I think I had a project to do. Didn't go back in 96. But I went back in 97, and that's what I began to do. Again, Global Exchange sponsored all of this. I did a language program at the University of Havana. It was hard, because I take everything so seriously. But anyway, did that language program. Then the next year, Global Exchange did the dance program. Mm-hmm. So I went back in 98, and that's how I met my husband, because he was, when we did the dance program, they did a combination. It was folklorical, there was religious dance, and then there was popular. Mm-hmm. And so along with the religious, you had to learn the music to go along with that. Mm-hmm. And so he was the percussionist and taught us some of the music. So that's how we met. And I've been going, I guess, my last trip to Cuba was last month, so I guess I've been going to Cuba. So I think I completed my 26th trip. Back and forth to Cuba. So I feel like I know a lot mm-hmm. About Cuba. It's home. Mm-hmm. I really is home. So when Cubans get to talking, I still don't understand everything they say, but, I kind of get most of it.
Okay. Some of these things we've touched on in your first comment about Cuba, but did you have ideas about Cuba when you were a teenager, when you had that first opportunity at 16? What was it that was...
Oh, dancing.
Just dancing.
Yeah.
Okay. So what was your reason for going there? Again, we've touched on that, mm-hmm. the global exchange opportunity mm-hmm. that you mm-hmm. had. What did you anticipate finding or experiencing there?
Something different. Mm-hmm. I had done some research about the revolution, and so I was really hoping to see a revolution, mm-hmm. you know, something different. And so, it changed my life.
Okay.
Changed my life.
What was your experience there? How were you treated by taxi drivers, hotel staff, and locals? Are there any... Okay.
Embrace. And one of the things that you do have to be careful about is the... When Fidel opened Cuba up, he said, our lives are going to change. And so one of the major ways it has changed is sex tourism.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the major ways it has changed. So, you know, one of the things you had to be concerned about was, you know, people attaching, men mm-hmm. attaching themselves mm-hmm. to you because they wanted... Mm-hmm. I wanted something. So one of the things that was always important for me with my husband was he never was interested in being with me in order to get a green card. He never wanted to come to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, he does not want to live in the United States. And just the way he presented himself as such a gentleman.
Mm-hmm.
So I felt comfortable, you know, began to, of course, felt comfortable, and I began to trust him. So that was one of the, in terms of taxi driving, no, because when the Global Exchange offer bus, the transfer, you know, from one spot to another.
Okay.
But I had, in all the times that I have been to Cuba, I have never been treated poorly. Now, some of the CDI, this was the CDI, community defense. Mm-hmm. You know, they know when I'm there.
Mm-hmm.
And they have come to the door and said, you know, da-da-da-da, and I said, yeah, you know. So people know, now I'm known.
Mm-hmm.
So people know me when I'm there. You know, there's not any difficulty. Mm-hmm. And people look out for me, because mm-hmm. Wade says, you know, she's not real fluent yet in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to work, because he's a musician. So I'm going to have to work tonight on one of the military bases. His group, the group that he is with, sometimes they will go and entertain the military.
Mm-hmm.
But she's in the house by herself, so, you know, mm-hmm. keep an eye on everything. So, you know, mm-hmm. I feel comfortable. Mm-hmm. We have two dogs. Cora, at night, Cora works one side of the house, and Choji works the other side of the house. So, yeah, I feel very comfortable.
Are there any particular encounters that stick in your mind? With just the, you know,
the deaf, visiting that deaf mm-hmm. school. Just visiting. There's so many encounters that stick mm-hmm. in my mind. And those encounters have to do with how Cuba takes care mm-hmm. of their people.
Mm-hmm.
I've never had a chance to meet Fidel. I've seen him from every year, each province. The province who does the most, I think, in terms of meeting goals, they're honored. So mm-hmm. I did have a chance to hear him speak in Guantanamo. And then I went to a conference where Alarcon, who's the president of the People's Assembly, mm-hmm. was there. But that wasn't necessarily outstanding
mm-hmm.
For me. But I think it was outstanding was, you know, hanging out with the kids and seeing mm-hmm. them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you form a special bond with any individuals or communities while there? Tell us a bit about that.
The delightful thing was, met him and Ray in 98, corresponded, because he asked if he could send me letters, corresponded, went back the next year, did the dance program again. That's when he asked, proposed. I said, I need to think about this. Hopped off the plane, scooted into the nearest therapist and said, don't sit there and say, oh, how do you feel about this? Tell me, let's talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the concerns that I had was the discrepancy in the economic discrepancy and the age discrepancy. Mm-hmm. I'm older, considerably older. And so we talked about it. And then I went back in December and I accepted his proposal. And so we were married 2 years later. And Global Exchange was still doing their dance programs. So 12 of my friends from the States via Global Exchange did mm-hmm. the dance program so they could be there
mm-hmm.
to attend the wedding.
Oh.
So that was really, really, really special. A couple things about the wedding that was so special was, you know, of course, my parents, you know, they were long deceased. But as we were getting to the church, because we were married in the Episcopal Cathedral, my witness handed me a bunch of yellow roses, which was my mother's favorite flower and favorite color, and I had taken my dad's tie clip
mm-hmm.
For me to wear. But it wasn't any music, because we didn't plan for that. But all the birds, this is a old cathedral with open windows at the ceiling, all the birds came in and they sang mm-hmm. the entire time while the ceremony was going on. Mm-hmm. So that was really special.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about some other places you've traveled. Would you like to focus on Brazil, perhaps, or which of the that you've listed would you like to talk a bit more in depth about?
I've been to Brazil twice. The first time in Brazil was in, I think, 1973. Because I was, again, at that time I wasn't married, but I was living with, I guess I kind of focused toward artists. He was a musician. And so the idea was that he would go to Brazil and live there, and he could study Brazilian jazz. So we went to Rio. And we could not stay because Kubitschek had just finished building Brasilia, mm-hmm. which was that new capital, and he really broke the country. So, you know, if I look back on it, it really wasn't that expensive, but it was expensive for us. Mm-hmm. We didn't stay. We stayed 3 months, but we didn't stay any longer.
What did you think about Brazil before going there?
Rio de Janeiro and Sugarloaf. Mm-hmm. Seeing that high mountain just really intrigued me. And I guess although big parades don't really get me that much, but I think it was just Brazil. Mm-hmm. So far. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time mm-hmm. out of the country. That was my first trip abroad. Yes, I was really excited about that. For me, I don't have a good ear, and Portuguese is a lot of sounds. And we had been eating the same thing. And so I fully walked past the store, and there was a chicken in the window rotisserie. Mm-hmm. And I said, I don't want one of those chickens because I'm tired of eating hot dogs. So I went in, and I didn't know how to say I want one of the chickens, but I pointed, and I went, and so that got me what I needed. And so every time we'd go in there, they would just have the biggest laugh. Here she comes, Chicken.
Okay. What are the earliest images you recall seeing or having about the people from that area?
From Brazil? Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Beautiful people. Mm-hmm. Physically. Mm-hmm. Beautiful people. Instead of people, primarily. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Beautiful people. That's about it, I guess.
Did you have ideas about Brazil as a child or teenager? Mm-hmm.
Just intrigued by the distance.
Mm-hmm. We've touched on this. What was your reason for going there? And what did you anticipate finding or experiencing?
To live there. I'm really hoping to live there. I had the experience of living outside of the country. Mm-hmm. So I was disappointed that, we couldn't stay.
Okay. What was your experience there? How were you treated, again, by taxi drivers, hotel staff, locals, whoever you encountered trying to explore making a life there?
I don't remember anything negative.
Okay.
I don't remember anything negative.
Anything sticks out in your mind positively, or?
That was a later trip. No, I don't think so. Can't think of anything right now.
Did you form a special bond with any individuals or communities while there?
One man, he took us around a little bit. And we corresponded for a while and then lost touch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Is there another one of your travels you'd like to focus on? I could pick one. Martinique is intriguing to me just because I've never met anybody that's been there. But if there's anything that, you know.
I'll just say something briefly about Haiti because on that first trip we did go to Haiti.
Okay. Go ahead. Let's do Haiti. Let's do the series of in-depth questions with Haiti. So okay. What did you think about Haiti before going there?
College, one of the people that I hung out, my hangout space in college was the International Club. Mm-hmm. Like I said, my parents weren't joiners, so I never was interested in any of the Greek organizations. So my hangout was the International Club, and so I knew one guy from Haiti. He was a pianist and did a little group, and I did a little dancing and that kind of thing. So I was looking forward to going to Haiti. I thought, well, when I get there, I'll look him up. And I knew there was another guy who was also part of that group. His mother, he wasn't Haitian, but his mother lived there. So I had heard a little bit about Haiti. And I think, I can't remember whether or not by that time I had read Lydia Bailey, the book, the novel, Lydia Bailey. And I think I knew something about L'Ouverture and Dessalines before I went, I'm not for sure.
What are the earliest images you recall seeing or having about the people of Haiti?
The poverty. Mm-hmm. The poverty. We stayed at a hotel near, I guess it would be Central, the park, one of the parks, and at night the students would come to the park and you would hear all this kind of low bum people? Yes, because they were doing their lessons. Because mm-hmm. they didn't have electricity at their homes. So they would come to the park mm-hmm. To study. And quite accidentally, the fellow that just got through talking about, Tony, the hotel we stayed in, he walked into the hotel. We hadn't seen each other for about 27 years or something like this. He walked into the hotel. So the next day, a couple of days afterwards, he took us out to a resort. Also in Haiti, it was the first experience. Well, let me see if I can finish these thoughts. He took us to a resort. People around the hotel were dark skinned. The people at the resort were all mixed race mm-hmm. and light. Mm-hmm. No dark-skinned people. The disparity, I tell you ladies, the disparity. You know, we had lobster, you know, people were bringing, oh yeah, the people who were serving were darker skinned, bringing drinks and that kind of thing. The next day we had to go into Port-au-Prince to see if we could get some money because we were running out of money. Do you remember the old Westerns? Gabby Hayes, you're probably too young for all of that, but a lot of the sidewalks in the West were wooden.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is downtown Port-au-Prince, the capital. The sidewalks were wooden. And there was, and you know, the open sewers. And there was a woman. She had a bundle on her back. She sat down. She was in rags. She sat down. She took this bundle off her back. And she opened a bundle. And it was a baby. It was covered with sores. Mm-hmm. And she was trying to feed this baby. The day before, you know, lounging in a hammock.
Mm-hmm.
And then see this. Went into a bank because we were again trying to get money. By this time, the hotel owner was being arrogant and making inappropriate advances to me. I was not alone. I was with Rob.
Mm-hmm.
But we went into this bank. And there were all these people waiting to try and get their money cashed. And I said, oh my God, this is going to take all day. It didn't take all day. They couldn't write and they couldn't read.
Mm-hmm.
So they were just ignored. So we just swooped in
mm-hmm.
and, you know,
took care
of what we needed to take care of. And all these people were still waiting.
Mm-hmm.
The two-town recruits, they were not. Papa Doc, Baby Doc was in power. The two-town recruits were still around. You know, nasty-looking guys with these big guns mm-hmm. on their hips. Anyway, those are some of my, that was kind of my experience in Haiti.
Okay.
The poverty and the disparity.
Mm-hmm. Did you have ideas about Haiti as a child or teenager?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah, we've kind of touched on your reason for going there. Mm-hmm. What did you anticipate finding or experiencing?
I'm not sure I can remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how we just found out about Haiti, because when we left Brazil, we were trying to think other places to go, and so maybe more than Rob, which maybe we wanted to go. Maybe more than not. I don't know. No, I think we both wanted to go. I think I wanted to go. So, and then maybe to find, you know, some of these kids that I had grown, that I've gone to school,
mm-hmm.
yeah, which I didn't, except for once for Tony.
You already shared a bit of your experience there with being so moved by the disparity. And how were you treated by, again, taxi drivers, hotel staff? You talked about some of that, the hotel manager and the special treatment
mm-hmm.
At the bank and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Any other encounters or experiences?
Yeah, I was getting ready to wash some clothes, and one of the maids tried to insist on washing the clothes. And I said, I can wash my own clothes. I mean, that's what I always do. And then she said, you know, I didn't speak Patois.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, but you'll ruin your nails. Nails? Oh, am I going to be worried about nails, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That was an experience. And then there was this other experience. I think he was Canadian. And like a lot of Haitians traveled to Canada
mm-hmm.
and also went to school in Canada. I think he was Canadian. Maybe he was English. Anyway, he was a drunkard, alcoholic, ne'er-do-well. And he was married to Marie Florence, beautiful woman, an artist. I saw some of her work around there. Why the two of them hooked up, I could never know, but they tolerated him. Her family tolerated him. And there was this young man who was a singer, and they were doing some entertainment at the hotel. He was similar to Harry Belafonte, only he was a shorter version. Kind of a shorter version of Harry Belafonte, but kind of similar. And this asshole was supposed to be was trying to act as his manager. So here was this guy, this wonderful guy, singing his wonderful song, and there's this drunk ne'er-do-well, you know, trying to direct him downstage, down, you know, showing off. Showing off, just disgusting. That's disgusting. I finally said to Rob, we got to leave here and now. But it was hard to get out because we didn't have any money. So we actually had to borrow money from the hotel room to leave. So that was sort of my experience. Oh, here's another experience with Haiti. Which this is my first time out of the U.S. This is key. U.S. One Drop Theory.
Yes.
In Brazil, in Haiti, as well as in Cuba, a whole range of colors that are acknowledged. So I have to admit, for a fleeting moment, I thought, and then I thought, what are you talking about? What's happening to you? And I thought, oh God. You know, I've since resolved that, but that was my first. That was my first, part of my first reaction to that. So that was significant. That was a significant occurrence.
Did you form a special bond with any individuals or communities? Do you have any mementos from that trip?
From Haiti? In Brazil? That first trip or just in general?
From both.
Yeah, from Brazil? I don't think so. I'm sure I do. I probably have a cookbook. I would always tend to my cookbooks.
How did your family and friends respond when you told them that you were going to any of those places that we talked about?
I think my mother was a little bit concerned about my safety, because I went to Spain by myself. So it was my 40th birthday present to myself. So she, like I said, talking about broadening your horizons, but she didn't quite have, I don't think she quite had a trip to Spain. By myself. I think they were okay with it. What astounded me, I think, was they did not ask lots of questions about my experience. So I'm not sure exactly what was going on.
Well, how did they respond to the stories that you would tell when you got back from these trips?
They lived in Detroit, and I would go back to California.
Okay.
So a lot of it would have had to be over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother by that time was retreating into not being well. I say retreating because it was a way of controlling my dad. So a lot of the focus on the conversations were about, you know, how is she doing that kind of thing. So there wasn't a lot of things. I don't remember being a lot of questions. Well, tell us about this. Or tell us about about that.
Did you stay in touch with anyone after you returned to the U.S.? Anyone you met in Haiti or
no?
No, I know not Haiti. Anyone in?
But of course, I maintain contact with people.
Did you ever encounter other U.S. African Americans there? If so, did you spend time together, and was there a sense of connection?
In most of those other places, other than Cuba, I don't recall seeing a lot of Afro-Americans are connected. Don't remember.
now in Canada on some of the global exchange trips. Afro-Americans.
Okay.
But not a whole lot. Not a whole lot.
Was there any connection with other Black Americans when you do encounter them? Is it a, you know, a sense of...
With one person kept in contact with Stephen, and he died of a heart attack. And then my friend Peggy, who's moved to Panama, she was on a trip, so of course I maintained contact with her.
Yeah. Okay. Did you have any flirtations with any of the locals? Just think about all of your travel experience, and what was that like for you?
I never traveled. Well, I'll take it back. Wait a minute, because I was kind of focusing on the Caribbean. In the Caribbean, I think I was not alone. I didn't travel alone. Now in Spain, that was a different question.
This is the 41st day president you've been involved, right?
Yeah, went crazy. In Spain, I was sitting in a restaurant, minding my own business. And so the waiter came over and said, the gentleman at the table would like to buy you a glass of wine. I said, okay, you buy your glass of wine. And so then he came over and started talking. He was a captain of a Norwegian ship. So, fools and babies. I went aboard his ship. Sure, he showed me around. And then when I got back, I guess it was the following summer, I got a letter, because we did some corresponding. I got a letter from him, and he invited me to come to Oslo as a guest.
Yes, okay.
So that's how I got to Oslo.
Yes.
And so some friends of his came up from Germany, and so we just drove around. And I remember being in a kind of far point in Oslo, in Norway, and we walked into a restaurant, and every single solitary soul in the restaurant turned around to look, because people of African descent were not prevalent. I'm sure probably this was the first time. Maybe they had seen somebody with African descent. So that was a nice trip. It was fun. We didn't stay in contact. But while I was in Oslo, again, minding my own business. Oh, I'm always minding my own business. I say that because I'm not, when I go, generally I'm not looking for men, just because I'm just excited about going to see the place. Anyway, again, I was in this department store, and I never had anybody have this reaction to me. But he stopped, and he stared. And I went on another floor, and I was looking at glassware, and I turned around, and he finally introduced himself, and so we had lunch together or something like that. So, and then in Spain, I flirted, or allowed myself to be flirted with in Spain. So those are kind of the flirtations.
Okay. Did you feel more sensual or beautiful there than at home in Spain or any place you
always
think of?
I'm a different person when I'm in Cuba.
Are you? Why do you think that is?
I come alive when I'm in Cuba. I like the weather, of course. I like the tropical. You know, I feel like, you know, all the moisture in my skin, of course, you know, raised there. But, and the music, it's the sensuality. I mean, Cuba's very erotic. I don't know whether you all have ever seen Cuban rumba.
Yes.
Yeah,
I'm not sure I have.
Destiny is not like Arthur. Remember Arthur Murray? You know, you probably even know who Arthur Murray is.
I've heard of Arthur Murray.
Criminal Happenings in Your Life, Try Dancing. Arthur Murray, you know, rumba can also be ballroom. But it's not very, you know. That is not Cuban rumba. Cuban rumba is foreplay. And I have got to learn. my name is not connected. I have got to learn this. But
just a brief little history of Cuban Roomba. It's very different. It's very erotic. How it got started was in the late 1800s, the dock workers were Afro-Cuban. And so they would be down working, you know, working the docks, these stevedores, and they'd say, "Hey, how's your old lady today?" And they'd say, "Oh, Lord, you know, she hadn't cooked yet," you know, kind of thing. And they would, you know, trade these stories back and forth. And then, of course, Africa drumming got put to it. Mm-hmm. So Roomba is about, this is how it got started. And so it's about penetration, it's about protection, and it's all done to very intricate kinds of rhythms. So, I mean, and, you know, you can walk down the street in Cuba, you can hear somebody practicing. My husband's a percussionist, so mm-hmm. you know, he's always practicing. You know, but we have, you know, in the dining room, you know, his congas are sitting there. I don't move them because they look like pieces of sculpture to me. So there's that in the air. So, you know, in Cuba, where my Daisy May, you remember Daisy May, Roy Abner? And you guys are too young.
Little Abner, I know Little Abner, I don't remember the Daisy May character.
You don't remember the Daisy May? Daisy May wore shorts up to her.
Oh, like Daisy Dukes?
I guess all the Daisies wore
all the shorts. Okay. Well, when I'm in Cuba, you know, I don't want a house.
Mm-hmm.
But that's how I feel comfortable enough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and once I started going to Cuba, I started wearing braids.
Because
mm-hmm. I didn't wear braids before. I feel different.
Mm-hmm.
Differently when I'm there.
Okay. What was your sense about how the locals viewed U.S. African-American women traveling there? And by there, we can just address any of the areas that we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think they thought you were there for?
In Spain, I remember one person was really attracted to me. I didn't act on anything. But I think just attracted, because I don't think they saw that in me, which now, of course, has changed. When I was first thinking about moving outside of the country, I applied to Spain
uh-huh.
for what they call their Schengen uh-huh. retirement. They never responded
uh-huh.
to me, because you have to send a photo, so that took care of it.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of these North Africans are coming into Spain, so Spain doesn't want.
Uh-huh.
Now, I've heard some very bad stories now about Spain.
Uh-huh.
I hope to be there if Wei and the group... they've been invited to travel
mm-hmm.
there in a couple of weeks, so I may be going into Spain for the second time since I've been there. So I'll be interested to see.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not heard some good stories about Spanish reaction
mm-hmm.
to African Americans, and certainly my experience was, you know,
mm-hmm.
they did not respond to my application
mm-hmm.
when I made it. In Cuba, like I said, I think Cuba, I think. Again, you know, it kind of got turned around. A lot of the people that went on the global exchange tours were white females,
mm-hmm.
and so there was this kind of white women after black men
mm-hmm.
for all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of exploitation
mm-hmm.
Going on. But I felt like I was always treated with respect.
Because
I think a lot of that maybe has to do with the fact that, you know, I like men. I think they're nice people, but I'm not always googling or ogling
mm-hmm.
or after them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Okay. Have you ever seen or heard of the book or movie How Stella Got Her Groove Back?
Uh-huh.
How do you see yourself in relation to Stella? Similar? If so, in what ways? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In what ways different?
I think I just tried to say I like men.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're, you know, they're a nice part of the population.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't spend my time oogling them, ogling them, or trying to go after them.
Okay.
Now, maybe that's because men have always gone after me.
Mm-hmm.
And I can decide whether I want to be bothered or whether I don't want to be bothered. But
mm-hmm.
I have never chased men.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Describe your experiences with bureaucratic entities when entering or exiting countries.
The first one was that first trip I went to Cuba. because I cleared customs in the Bahamas. It was American.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they were, it was a way to save time.
Mm-hmm.
So he tried to hassle me. He was African American. He tried to hassle me about, oh, you're not supposed to be going to Cuba. And I said, I have a license to go to Cuba. So he stood there. He said it again. I said, I have a license to go to Cuba. This went on maybe for 4 or 5 minutes, and finally he stamped it.
Mm-hmm.
So for that reason, I don't travel out of Miami.
Mm-hmm.
I do not travel out of Miami.
Yeah.
I remember one time, it was me, I was trying to run a number on this customs agent because I had bought, while I was in Venezuela, they had nice gems, and so I'm kind of partial to,
mm-hmm.
I don't like so much costume jewelry, I like,
mm-hmm.
got partial to gems,
mm-hmm.
so I always wanted some emeralds.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought some emerald earrings, but they were over what you were allowed,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't want to have to pay more
mm-hmm.
for them. So I get to the customs, before I get to the customs in Jizzy, I'm sort of put paint on my face, I'm sort of hopping around, and he said, so welcome home, how did you like your trip? I said, I got to go to the bathroom. I don't know, I ate something all over South America. I've been running around looking for bathrooms, and I have to go right now. Go on. So I have to, took advantage
mm-hmm.
of that. But I would like to say something, but I don't want to take.
Okay.
So we'll just turn the tape off.